Philip Lopate's publishing history has taken an interesting arc. 2 volumes of poetry, then 2 novels, 3 personal essay collections, also film criticism, a book about New York's waterfront. And now, after 20 years, he's returned to fiction, but this time in the novella form. 2 Marriages is published by The Other Press. I'm pleased that it has brought Philip back to the show today. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This book has gotten terrific reviews, the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, the LA Times. Are you sorry you waited 2 decades to return to fiction?
Fiction is difficult for me, and I felt in a way when I wrote these like I was taking a real chance, but I wanted to have fun, and basically the idea was to write certainly the first novella in a comic vein.
Now, you said that it's difficult for you. I'll get to the comic vein later. After writing about yourself in your personal essays, wouldn't it have been liberating to be able to totally invent things?
Well, it is liberating, especially because I was writing about marriage, and I knew that if I had written personal essays about marriage, I would have had my head handed to me.
You would have had to tell the truth unless you were James Frey or somebody like
yes.
that.
So I knew I had to fictionalize, and I wanted to fictionalize, and it was a great liberation to inhabit other people who are very different from myself.
Is it a vacation? Because you do a number of different things. You also teach, and I assume you continue writing criticism and other things.
I do, yes.
So is this a matter of switching one part of your brain to the other, or is it all part of the same thing?
You know, it's a continuum. For instance, when I write personal essays, I'm often a little bit mischievous and kidding around and playing around with the idea that the narrator, myself, is kind of slightly obnoxious or maybe a little bit provocative. So it's like adding chemicals to a potion, you know. And when I write fiction, I'm adding more chemicals.
Well, because I assume that your approach to writing, finding a voice, yeah. has changed as a result of you having written all of those personal essays.
It definitely has, and in fact, especially in The Stoic's Marriage, the longer of the 2 novellas, I availed myself of the opportunity to have kind of mini essays. Which my slightly feckless narrator issued. And this was a lot of fun to write kind of mini essays in somebody else's voice, somebody who actually saw the world rather differently than I did.
It also allowed you to talk about some of the things that I'm sure every memoirist thinks about. This is a journal, and he's wondering whether
exactly.
he might have it published someday.
Yes.
It's something that people do think about when they're writing.
He's an amateur.
But they wonder, am I writing for myself? And if that's the case, why? Or yeah. am I writing with the idea that someday this journal might be published? Yeah. And I guess that's what every memoirist asks as well. Is this interesting to me alone, or would the rest of the world find this interesting?
Well, that's a very basic question, which is my story going to have universal resonance, or is it so peculiar that people are just going to throw up their hands, you know?
So how does he convince himself that his wonderful love story deserves a wider audience?
Oh, I don't know that he ever gets it published, but I got it published.
he writes as though yeah. he is writing to
that's part of the
wide audience.
The dilemma of the diary, you know, is that every time you write in your diary, my cousin Morty, who is blah blah blah, and you think, well, I know that. Why am I writing this? Who am I writing this to? And so it's almost impossible to escape writing for an audience, even if you're just writing for yourself, you know. But in this case, I always liked these Russian novels that would say things like, you know, we came upon this diary, our boarder hanged himself, but he left this behind in lieu of rent or something like that. So this is a kind of found document, you might say.
Well, Gordon has already published a book. He's a classic scholar, and he's published A Slave's Wisdom, the Sayings of Epictetus.
Yes, but even that's a compilation rather than a book he wrote himself.
Even there he has this fantasy that it would be something that would be like an impulse buy at a bookstore or a supermarket checkout.
Gordon is an unambitious man who has underground ambitious impulses. So he does. He keeps having to correct his own ego, you might say. And in this case, he does. He wants to be humble and everything, you know. But there's a way in which he feels superior to everyone.
But it's I would assume that there's a certain challenge for you in creating a first person narrative,
yes,
of this sort, because it's almost like a good singer having to sing off key every so often. He's a clumsier writer than you are, and you have to make it somehow work without sounding like you're the clumsy writer.
Yeah, I think that all first-person fictions are a kind of comic impersonation. So even if a writer starts out very seriously, there's something innately comic about it.
You mean even if we're talking about nonfiction, if we're talking about personalizing?
No, I mean if you're writing a made-up story and you're doing it in a first-person voice, there's something funny about impersonating somebody else. And then for me also, I have to admit there's something funny about the novella form because it's compressed, and everything happens more spasmodically. It doesn't happen with this deliberation. So there's more of an opportunity for a kind of comedy, and I think that a lot of classical novellas exploit that.
Well, some reviewers have suggested that he's an unreliable narrator, but
I don't think he's unreliable.
Yeah, he's really just not as insightful as he could be.
He's reliable according to his own lights.
It's just that the reader is one or two steps ahead of him.
The reader
at all
may
times
be one or two steps ahead of him, but also one of the things that I'm trying to say is that very intelligent people can fool themselves. And also that intelligence can only take us so far. Intelligence is not necessarily wisdom, you know. And, you know, one of the things that he's trying to do is to use the philosophy of Stoicism to help him to adjust to one trouble after another. He begins the novella very happy. And then
he's a 48-year-old bachelor who's fallen in love with Rita,
who's
a 30-something Filipino nursing aide.
Yes.
And she's very beautiful. She had been hired. She's an illegal, but she was hired to take care of his dying mother, and then eventually they wind up being connected.
They have a kind of love/green card marriage, which is an oxymoron. But anyway, he keeps encountering one trouble after another and rationalizing it. And that's something that I exploit in my essays as well, the comedy of rationalization, how you try to fool yourself into thinking that something is okay when it's not okay.
Philip Lopate is here. Yes, he is my brother. And his latest book is two novellas called Two Marriages, published by Other Press. We'll continue our conversation after this. Later in the show, Salman Rushdie will be here to talk about his picks for the best short stories of the past year. Also, we'll find out why the years between 1815 and 1848 were so tumultuous in American history. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Philip Lopate is my guest. He is a novelist, essayist, critic, poet, editor, author, and brother, author of Waterfront, A Journey Around Manhattan, also Being with Children, which was the first published book. That was about teaching at PS 75.
And actually, it's just been reissued as a so-called classic of education by the New Press, so it's out in paperback again.
The latest is two novellas called Two Marriages from Other Press. And you mentioned, we've been talking about the fact that it's a novella form.
Yes.
Novella is an odd form because it's neither short story nor novel. Is it really a novel that just doesn't go that far? Or is it an extended short story? How do you see it?
It's its own creature. And I think that a lot of times I read contemporary novels and I think, you know, this really didn't need 350 pages. This could have been done so well in 150 pages. That's as much as I want to be with these people.
But sometimes isn't there pressure on writers to think novel form?
Well, sure, because a novella is not the most commercial form in the world. On the other hand, neither is a personal essay, so I excel at these uncommercial forms. But for me, when you think about it's funny. Somebody once wrote an essay, Howard Nemiroff, in which he said that the novella is often about identity. And obviously it can't be about too many characters. You can't put a cast like War and Peace in a novella. But something changes. I mean, Gregor Samsa turns into a cockroach, or you have The Secret Sharer by Conrad. But often there's this kind of doubt of appearances. I fell in love with some Latin American novellas by a writer named Adolfo Bucaceres. And in one of them, he falls in love with a woman who may be a kind of laser projection, maybe not real. And so it interested me how someone you're married to, you know and don't know.
And that's a theme that ties both of these together.
Yeah, because
that and the fact that both couples live in Brooklyn.
They both live in Brooklyn. But I think that that's because I live in Brooklyn and I didn't have to invent that. But to me, in a way, marriage is a long patience, and it's a very difficult, disciplined, difficult relationship, and has a chance to morph many times.
Now, the way you dealt with that, not necessarily knowing the spouse, even though you live with this person, mm-hmm. in one of the stories, is to make him partly clueless, even though he's smart.
Yes.
In the other one, you told it in third person from a number of perspectives.
Right.
And so each one of these people only understands a story from a certain perspective.
Exactly. And they're intelligent people who have who are good intentioned. But I love this statement I came upon recently by the wonderful British novelist Penelope Fitzgerald. She said, you should write biographies about people you admire and respect, and you should write novels about people who you think are sadly mistaken. And I think that my characters are sadly mistaken, but I like them a great deal in their mistakenness. So I don't try to ennoble them. They are mistaken because they can only glimpse a piece of the truth.
In this case, the story is called Eleanor or the Second Marriage, and that's important, the second marriage, because
yes.
Second marriages, we assume, you've gotten past all of the kinds of mistakes you might make
yes,
in the first marriage.
In fact, the main character, the protagonist of this, is a guy in his 50s named Frank, who's a successful sound engineer. And I think his feeling is that all of his crack-ups, all of his unhappiness were in the past, and that now now he's figured out, he's lowered his expectations, and he's also figured out how to be happy and how to be mature. And of course, again, I throw them one curve after another, because I don't think you ever reach that point. You can be 80, 90 years old, and life can still throw you a few surprises.
Well, on the surface, they appear to have a charmed life and a harmonious relationship. They have an active social life, no worries about money. They eat off of a Noguchi table.
Both these novellas
They live in Cobble Hill.
Both these novellas have characters who have money, and I think that's one of the prime fantasy elements, because they both have more money than I do. This is where being a fiction writer allows you to fantasize.
Well, I don't think anybody's going to – often you run into that whole business about how autobiographical this is.
Yeah, no, these are very different.
If people assume, Philip, yeah. that these stories are autobiographical, you are in trouble.
No, but everything is in a way autobiographical, in that they come from anxieties, desires, and subterranean material that you then transmutate.
In the case of Gordon in the first story, we learn all about him from the things that he doesn't realize he's revealing. In this story, we learn more about Frank through discussions he has with his adult son, Theo,
yes.
who is invited to a dinner party. In fact, this really takes place over a weekend in which there's a dinner party.
Exactly. You know, I was interested in this pattern that you see sometimes, somebody who's very successful in the arts, let's say, who has a son or daughter who seems very washed out or very vapid, like they don't seem fully alive, as though all the energy went to the parent, you know, and then there's this kind of passive rebellion that the child exerts. So there's something between the father and the son. There are lots of father and son scenes in this, and in many ways it really is a kind of father and son novella. And I guess I was watching a lot of people in the arts. This was before I had a child myself. I'm watching the way that children would sometimes interact with the famous parent.
Mm-hmm. And so you were dealing – is there a reason you chose to do this in third person? Because when you wrote this, this is an older story, isn't it?
I chose to do it in third person.
You were already writing almost exclusively in first person at that time.
Well, no, I've written, I mean, after all, The Rug Merchant, my novel is in third person. And in third person, I think the comedy comes from structuring the situations. In first person, it comes more through voice and tone.
Mm-hmm. I've resisted telling much of plot.
Good.
Because these stories both, you know, they develop and they learn more and more as they go on. And was plot important to you?
You know, I believe in plot. Ultimately, we're a storytelling animal, and I feel like you have to deliver surprise to the reader, and you have to make things happen. So ultimately, the reader in me insists on plot.
Coming up in the next hour, I'll be talking with Salman Rushdie, who has selected stories for a collection that you once appeared in. In fact, Best American Short Stories. But he says that he sees a return to naturalism.
Naturalism has deep resources, you know, and I don't think it will ever die out completely. You know, you still have a lot of wonderful short story writers who essentially are working in a naturalistic or realistic vein, and then you have ones who are working in a more experimental vein, and let many flowers bloom. That's my philosophy.
Although you tend to be a naturalist because of that memoirist impulse?
I would say I'm a psychological naturalist. That is, I'm very interested in psychology and character and people coming against their own limits and trying to alibi or rationalize their way out of them. I remember one time Dostoevsky said, "Why do they call me a psychologist? I'm a realist." And I always thought, it would be okay if they called me a psychologist. I like the word psychologist.
Well, maybe he was called a psychologist because he was a realist.
Something like that.
So does this mean – you said fiction is hard to write. Does this mean that you're going to try doing it again, or are you going to put it off for a while because you'd rather do easier things?
Well, it isn't it's not just easy. It's that when I write fiction, it's like having a fever. I have to enter a dream. And it sometimes months or years go by till I can come out of it. And that's what I mean by uncomfortable. I don't think my next book will be fiction, but then I think I definitely will continue to write novels and novellas, especially because this one has been so well received.
Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations on the reception that it's gotten. I know when we talked about it before it was published, you were concerned that some people might not get it. And yet everybody seems to have.
I was terrified, partly because I was dealing with material that could be misconstrued as sexist. Whenever you deal with the relations between men and women, watch out, you know. But
because people often confuse the narrator with the author.
Yeah, or the plot with the author. Yes, exactly. But somehow...
This has been Philip Roth's problem sometimes over the years.
Exactly. Much better writer than I am, yes.
So you were worried that that was going to happen to you, and yet everybody seems to have gotten it. Either it's because you were brilliant and you achieved what you hoped to achieve,
or
maybe the reviewers,
or
the reviewers are smarter than you thought they might be.
Yes. In any case, I am grateful.
And I am grateful that you came by again, Philip. It's always a pleasure to see you on a professional basis.
We see each other a lot, and Happy New Year to you, Lenny.
And I suddenly realized that I have another minute to go, Phil.
Oh, good.
I misread the clock. So is there anything important any other revelations you've had recently?
Well, I just want to say that I'm practicing stoicism because of the Mets, and I'm trying to both rationalize and be philosophical at the same time.
Now, how did you wind up making Gordon a stoic, of all things? Had you been reading stoic philosophy?
I'm actually very attracted to stoicism as an idea, and I wish that I could really be one, you know. It's a very demanding discipline, but the idea of...
But you may come into a bit of a boob.
No,
being a stoic.
No, it's just too difficult to be able to have such a philosophical serenity about things.
And a friend of his actually points out that stoicism is almost impossible, but then he has an equally ridiculous view of life.
Yeah, but you could say the same thing about Buddhism in a way, that it's extremely demanding, you know, to actually reach a point of enlightenment, but that doesn't mean it's not worth doing.
Philip Lopate's Two Marriages is published by The Other Press. And Philip, Thank you so much for coming by.
My pleasure.